coming up on New York Now.
I have no spirituality. I don't believe in God. I will never set foot in a church if I don't have to.
A discussion about the one-time legal look-back window that is approaching for victims of childhood abuse.
To have them validate what I'm saying is extremely powerful.
Yeah, you want to be heard.
I want to be heard, and I want to be believed, which with the church is never going to happen.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Governor Cuomo signed a number of gun control measures this week in Albany, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio make perhaps their last appearance at a Democratic presidential debate. Those are just two of the topics to discuss at this week's Reporters Roundtable, where my partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, will lead our discussion.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news, I'm happy to be at the Reporters Roundtable with my friends Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio and John Campbell from the USA Today Network. All right, relatively slow week. We're into August, but there were a lot of bill signings, including several by the governor concerning gun control and gun legislation, prompted perhaps by a story by Tom Precious in the Buffalo News that noted that a lot of these bills had been kind of hanging around for 4 months or more. They included a ban on the possession or sale of weapons that cannot be picked up by metal detectors, such as 3D printed weapons, safe storage for gun owners who have children under the age of 16 in the household, the bump stock ban, and an extension of waiting periods for certain gun sales.
Yeah, as long as a 30-day waiting period for people who have been flagged initially when they're trying to buy a gun, that's because the FBI says it takes 28 days to perform a full background check. And that bill was passed back in January. So there were some questions raised of why hasn't the governor signed it yet. And I would note that these were all done by press release and not in his usual bill signing kind of event, maybe because he didn't want questions about, well, why did it take you so long? Also because Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris was the sponsor of that, and Cuomo doesn't get along with him too well. I think the whole scenario this summer has been Cuomo signing bills, and it's more about the governor, I did all this, and kind of leaving the legislature out, because he wasn't all that happy when the legislature sort of ran away with a lot of proposals back in during the session.
And I think when we're talking about, you know, which of these bills would have the most practical impact, certainly on gun owners, it's the safe storage law. And that is, it expands the state's law that requires you to lock your guns in a safe or a cabinet, something with a lock, essentially. Before, that only applied to people who lived with people who weren't allowed to possess a gun, whether they had a felony conviction or a domestic violence charge, anything like that. Now it expands to anyone who lives with someone under the age of 16 or is reasonably expecting a visit from somebody under
such as a grandparent, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The governor also signed the bill that was also passed, that one only, I think, about 2 months ago, on marijuana decriminalization. This was significant. It allows for the quashing of certain arrest records for low-level marijuana offenses. And, John, lots of people, of course, say that it doesn't go far enough. They're hoping for full legalization and the creation of an adult-use marijuana industry. You did a great story last week looking at the economic impact on Western Massachusetts marijuana dispensaries on cross-border trade.
Yeah, and you know, for cross-border trade, something like that, yes. There's four different recreational marijuana dispensaries that are within 15 miles of the New York border in Massachusetts. And I went and visited a few of those, one in Great Barrington, the other in Lee. And they both say that more than 50% of their business are from New York customers, and that's because it's not legal in New York. You can't legally go to a dispensary and buy recreational marijuana. If New York had legalized marijuana at the end of session, you know, it's not like the floodgates would have opened immediately and there would have been dispensaries. But,
yeah,
you know, these Massachusetts shops are getting quite a bit of New York customers. I mean, and it's undoubtedly had a big impact on their bottom line. That being said, you know, New York wasn't able to legalize marijuana at the end of June. They had this kind of backup plan to further decriminalize. Basically, if you have under an ounce, you're going to get a $50 fine. And that is what that was their backup plan that they were able to approve and Cuomo signed this week.
Yeah, well, the Berkshires, they're close enough to New York City, so it's not that far to go. A lot of people vacation there. I think a lot of people go over there for medical needs as well, because the medical marijuana is very limited in New York State. Yeah, so I think and they're really taking in a lot of tax revenue, Massachusetts, that New York would have received eventually if they had legalized marijuana.
And, you know, the tax revenue, I think the state, New York, was estimating if they allowed it, it would be about $300 million, mm-hmm. which is, you know, in the course of a $160 billion-plus budget is not that much, but it's also not nothing. And that's one of the reasons why Governor Cuomo, who for years was the state's most powerful opponent of legalization, that's one of the things that flipped him over to the side of, ostensibly, the side of favoring legalization.
And a lot of advocates believe that they can do it in 2020, even though it's an election year, because they say polls show that a lot of New Yorkers support it, so they're going to try again. They don't think decriminalization is enough, because you can still be arrested. Mm-hmm. You could get a parole violation. If your immigration status is questionable, you could be deported if you're arrested for marijuana possession, even if the outcome would just be, you know, a ticket for $200 or something like that, up to 2 ounces. So this is definitely not the end of this issue.
Pulling back to look at national politics for a few minutes, this was also debate week in America.
That's the, right.
The two
6 hours.
Yes, two presidential debates in Detroit. The second night, Wednesday night, included the two high-profile New York candidates, Kirsten Gillibrand and Mayor Bill de Blasio. How did they do?
I think de Blasio had some pretty embarrassing moments when the protesters were yelling about they wanted that New York City cop fired, who his actions resulted in the death of Eric Garner, and they were yelling during de Blasio's opening remarks.
They were actually yelling during Cory Booker.
Yeah, I was going to say, they were yelling more during Cory Booker's remarks, and I couldn't understand what they were saying watching it on TV, so I had to go to Twitter to find out what was going on, because I thought, are they mad at Cory Booker? What is going on here? So that was like a pretty embarrassing start for de Blasio, and I think he got called on that. He got called on the NYCHA, New York City Public Housing, having the lead crisis. He said, I'm fixing it, but that's been going on for a long time. He tried to portray himself as, I'm the progressive here, the rest of you aren't, but I don't know how successful it was.
And Kirsten Gillibrand, the other New Yorker in the race, she had a moment that some of these candidates who are struggling to gain in the polls and struggling to fundraise, including her, including de Blasio, would dream of. And that is, she had a quick soundbite clip that went viral, really. She said she was, her first act as president is she was going to Clorox the Oval Office. And within a day, she was selling stickers saying that. And, you know, it bounced around the internet very quickly. And you know, and when you're in a crowded field, mm-hmm. Those are the things you dream of.
Yeah, pretty visual image. The question is, will it get her into the September debates, where the threshold is a lot higher? I mean, it's difficult, I think, for Democratic voters to see 20 different candidates and try to decide who's important, who isn't.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave the analysis. So thanks very much to John Campbell of the USA Today Network for coming in. So, Karen, on August 14th, the first lawsuits can be filed under the look-back window, which will last a year, made possible by the passage of the Child Victims Act. You spoke to two people who have a deep interest in that.
That's right. The Child Victims Act, after years of struggle, finally passed earlier this year and extended the statute of limitations to, I think, 28 for criminal cases if you're a victim of childhood sexual abuse, and 55 for civil cases. But that leaves out a whole lot of people who say that they were victimized in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and they have this one-year opportunity to file a lawsuit against the people that they're accusing of victimizing them. And it's going to be quite a deluge of cases, and I was lucky enough to speak to one of those survivors who shared his story along with his lawyer, Gordon Smith, and the attorney is Jennifer Freeman of Marsh Law Firm. Well, thanks for coming in, Jennifer and Gordon, and being willing to share your story, Gordon. I know it's not easy at all for you to come in here and do this.
Yes, it is not easy, correct.
Yeah, so you say you were abused by two priests in the Albany Diocese. One, former Father Donald Starks, who's now deceased and is on the diocese list of credibly accused priests, and another one in the 1960s when you were a teenager. Can you describe to us what happened?
When I was working, taking my father's job, because he couldn't work, he had to have surgery, and the Monsignor told us that the work had to be done.
And what kind of work was it?
My father was the custodian for St. Patrick's Church.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So part of the duty was going up and cleaning the rectory mm-hmm. on the first, second, and third floor. On the third floor, there was only one priest up there, and that's where the abuse began and went on 2 to 3 times a week for almost 3.5 years.
And how did the priest kind of, you know, hook you into that?
I'm not really sure. That memory has not totally, it's not totally clear on how he groomed me and got me and hooked me into it. I just know that when it started, it was very difficult to get through.
Mm-hmm. So you're 14, between 14 and 17. I mean, did you understand what was happening
I
at
did.
The time? You did?
And they told me that if I ever said a word, first of all, no one would believe me because it would be my word against a priest. Then they also said that they would make sure my father never worked again and ruined my family. My father was a veteran from World War II, and I grew up with guns in the house, and I knew that if he found out, there was going to be a problem because he would use one of the guns and go after him.
So you almost felt like you had to protect your father against himself.
I had to protect myself and my family. At one point growing up, my parents thought there was something wrong, sent me to a psychiatrist in Albany, and for the whole time I just sat there silent. I couldn't say a word because there was no such thing as privacy, mm-hmm. child privacy. So I was trapped.
That's a lot of burden on a child.
It is too much for any person, adult or child, to handle.
And can you talk about, if you're comfortable, what some of the incidents were, what kind of abuse occurred?
Well, it was about as horrific as it could get. We're talking about molestation. We're talking about sodomization. We're talking about oral sex.
So you didn't really tell anyone at the time, it sounds like.
No. I just know what I could tell. There's no one I could trust.
So there was no complaints to,
no.
you know, the diocese or anything like
nope.
that? Not that there was like avenues in those days, but.
There wasn't. The first time I said anything to the diocese was in 2005. I finally decided that it was time to get help, that I was going down and spiraling and I needed help. So my wife and I approached the diocese. I had 3 requests. One, therapy to heal. 2, that everything be kept completely confidential. And 3, I did not want to know where either one of the priests were at that time, alive or dead.
And what did they give you any of those things?
I got 1 therapy session before they cut it off because they said since there were no photographs or credible evidence, they didn't believe it. Then they followed up with a person from the diocese calling me and saying that one of the priests was alive and well in Colorado, and they had talked to him and he denied it. And the only way it left me to get the treatment I so desperately needed was to use my employee assistance program at work, to use my own health insurance. And so now everything that I wanted confidential is not only in my employee file at work, it's in my health record that every doctor and every person looks at will see. So basically, they turned me away.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like the impact on your life was pretty horrific.
Oh, it was.
But how did it affect you being, you know, going through your 20s, 30s, 40s?
Well, I started drinking at the age of about 15. And I drank probably to my early 20s. At which point I wanted to be married more than I did the alcohol, and I gave up the alcohol. But one of the things it taught me is you never tell the truth.
Hmm. Do you think that now?
There are points of time I do. That when you make a mistake, you don't talk about it. You hide it and hope it never gets found. Well, that hurt me a lot in a lot of different ways growing up. And it's only been with the help of therapy that I've realized that that's not the way to go. It's not the way to live your life. That when you make a mistake, there are less consequences if you look someone in the eye and say, I made a mistake, than there is if you run and hide it.
Yeah, so what is your relationship with the church now?
There is none. I have no spirituality. I don't believe in God. I will never set foot in a church if I don't have to. I mean, if a family member is getting married, I'll go. But it takes every ounce of strength I have to walk in the door.
Yeah, so since that, and it's attributed to what happened, right?
Absolutely.
There's just no way that you can heal that, you feel like.
There's no way that I will ever regain any belief in that. Because when you're being abused and the crucifix hangs on a wall, and as a child you're looking at it and saying, why are you letting this happen? And it continues. You get to believe that there is no God to help you. There is no help.
So now we're up to today. You have come forward. You're speaking publicly because you said even back in 2005 you didn't want anyone to know. Why have you made this decision? You're going to file a lawsuit, right?
I am.
Yeah.
I made the decision to come forward for a lot of reasons. One is there are a whole lot of people, a lot of young people that were abused and never made it, and there's no voice for them. If there's one person sitting out there that sees my story and hears me and says, hey, that was my situation too, and goes forward and talks to a doctor or talks to a therapist and gets help. Because so many of the people that were abused are now alcoholics, they're drug users, and because they see no way, they don't see any hope.
And maybe, not in a condition to, do all the things you're going to need to do.
But maybe if they hear my story and what happened to me, that will give them the strength to take a step.
Yeah. Now, can you talk about the specifics of your lawsuit, what you're seeking?
Well, the lawsuit is really on two levels. The first level is because I was denied by the church. Mm. To have a group of 12 people, 12 jurors, come back and say, we hear you, we believe you, is probably the best relief and the best peace of mind I could get. To have them validate what I'm saying is extremely powerful.
Yeah, you want to be heard.
I want to be heard, and I want to be believed, which with the church is never going to happen.
Yeah. So, Jennifer, you've represented many similar cases for many years, and it's not just the Catholic Church, right, this stuff has happened. What are some of the other cases that you've been involved in and groups that have perpetrated these things?
It's well beyond the Catholic Church. You're absolutely right. We certainly have cases against the Catholic Church. We have cases against other religious institutions. We have cases against the Boy Scouts. We have cases against doctors, such as the doctor Reginald Archibald in New York City. We have 200 of those. I can't tell you what the exact number is because it seems to change and grow every day, but we have approximately 515 cases today.
And this is before the August 14th window is opening up. I mean, I assume some people like Gordon are setting up their cases, but do you have any estimate of how many more cases are going to end up, not just your law firm, but in New York State? Does anyone know?
I don't think anyone knows. This is landmark legislation. This is a very important statute that has been passed. It's taken New York from being one of the worst places to bring a lawsuit and be heard mm-hmm. and listened to and believed for child sex abuse to one of the easier places or one of the more positive places for survivors to be heard.
Yeah, so it could be hundreds of cases.
Could
probably
be thousands.
Thousands. Yeah.
I think it's more like thousands. I don't think hundreds since we have 500 ourselves.
Yeah, so obviously, everyone needs to prove their case.
Absolutely.
So how do you go about that? I mean, what Gordon's talking about happened 50 years ago, I mean, some of the people, the witnesses, even, you know, one of the priests is deceased. Like, how do you build a case? What are some of the basics that you do?
One of the basics is to listen to survivors like Gordon. Make sure you hear them and listen to their stories. So that's an important piece of the evidence, is what happened according to him. And also to see what other, very often, as you know, from the credibly accused priest list, there are priests that are identified that have other charges against them. Other victims have come forward and said that that priest abused me. That certainly makes it more likely, especially when you have somebody that is repeatedly abusing children.
Yeah, proof of a serial abuser, that helps.
Yes.
But you know, do you go and try to find people from 50 years ago, try to see what they remember? See if there was anybody who witnessed it.
If you can. I think what Gordon's story is quite understandable and quite common in that he didn't tell anybody. And that's very, very common, whether it's because he was feared not being believed, whether it's because he was threatened, which he was. He was threatened that his family would be in ruins, or for other reasons. A lot of children did not come forward, and they kept it in themselves, this secret. They kept it for themselves.
What's the average dollar amount that people are seeking?
I don't think people know that. I don't think it's usually not a numbers game. More important than anything is accountability. They want to hold these institutions accountable for what happened to them. They want to be heard. They want to have their day in court.
Yeah, and as you said, Gordon, it's not really about the money.
It isn't.
But did you name a figure? I mean, you kind of have to. You didn't know?
I don't know.
And you don't need to. In New York courts, you don't need to, at this point, name a figure. That's going to depend on what are the individual damages, what is the effect for this particular person.
Okay, so finally, I want to ask you both if you have any advice to people who are survivors, maybe haven't told anybody, and are thinking about doing something about it, because now we have a time where there can be accountability in this one-year window. What would you say to them? Is it something, you know, that they should think about before they do, or what will they face?
Do you want to take that first?
I will. They should think about not the law. They should not think about filing a lawsuit. They should think about getting themselves healed, finding somebody to talk to that will listen, and getting the help necessary to go on and get peace in your life. The lawsuit is nice because, as we said, it gives you validation. Mm-hmm. But more important than the lawsuit is if there's one or two people sitting out there that are thinking, I'm afraid to come forward. If we can give them the courage to speak out or to seek help, that's more important than the lawsuit ever will be.
And we totally support that. It's often baby steps. Maybe you tell someone that you trust and care and cares about you. Maybe you start with that. Maybe you start with going to a therapist. And at some point, if you want to, you would be advised to go to an experienced lawyer in child sex abuse and understand your rights. We talk to many people about what their rights are. They don't have to bring a lawsuit. We're happy to talk to people and help them understand what their rights are, because it's really important to ground them in what they understand those rights to be.
Thank you both very much for coming in. We really appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Thanks for listening.
Karen, very emotional interview, clearly. Lots of institutions are going to be affected by this look-back window and the suits made possible by it, but certainly the Catholic Church, diocese, and individual Catholic orders are really preparing for this, probably with great litigation fear. What's the response from the church?
Well, we reached out to the Albany Catholic Diocese, and Bishop Edward Scharfenberger is releasing a video that I think is going to be made public any day now, where he's essentially saying, you know, we sympathize with the victims. We're listening to you. You shouldn't be afraid to come forward. We're going to hear you. So after years of opposition, they're finally saying, okay, you know, we acknowledge this. We're not going to fight it.
All right. Powerful stuff. Thanks very much. All right. Now we'll kick it back to Matt at the desk.
All right. Thanks, Casey and Karen. Do you approve of the gun control legislation signed into law this week by Governor Cuomo? That is our poll question. Let us know at nynow.org. A last week's show focused on a lawsuit where the environmental group Protect the Adirondacks filed to stop the continuation of a snowmobile trail inside the Blue Line. Our question asked, should a tree in the Adirondack Forest Preserve with a diameter of less than 3 inches be cuts for such a trail. This proved to be a very popular story and poll question. Lots of people voting, and the majority said yes. Keith, watching us on WPBS in Old Forge, a snowmobiling hotspot in the state, said, "It is ridiculous to count saplings as fully grown trees in order just to stop a trail from being built. Arbitrary and capricious." And finally, Ann in Syracuse, watching on WCNY, told us, "Leave the beautiful Adirondacks alone. There are plenty of areas for the few who ride snowmobiles." Our great thanks to all those who took the time to vote. We hope to hear from you again. Don't be shy. You can vote at nynow.org. It's where any of our past programs live. You can also follow links to us on social media, including Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. There's a link to the Capital Confidential blog on the website as well. It can also be found at timesunion.com. And that will do it for us today. Our send-off video is a field of orange tiger lilies in full bloom, a telltale sign of summer in the North Country. I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station. Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Ryan. If you like what you hear, rate and review us right on your mobile device. When you do so, it makes it a little easier for people trying to find us. And thanks so much for listening to the New York Now podcast.